This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Doctor's Kitchen. Recipes, health, lifestyle.
Really, the only downside of organic food is the cost. And if that's something that, you know, you can afford, then certainly while, you know, you're trying for a baby and the sort of, you know, the cellular changes matter, just for 3 months or while you're trying, if you could swap over to an organic diet, I think that would be helpful. And certainly, if you can't, wash your fruit and vegetables really well.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast. The show about food, lifestyle, medicine, and how to improve your health today. I'm Dr. Rupi, your host. I'm a medical doctor, I study nutrition, and I'm a firm believer in the power of food and lifestyle as medicine. Join me and my expert guests where we discuss the multiple determinants of what allows you to lead your best life. On the show today, we are talking about everything to do with eating for fertility with a colleague of mine, Dr. Harriet Holm. She's also a regular contributor to the Doctor's Kitchen website. She is a registered nutritionist and an experienced pediatrician in the NHS. After studying at Cambridge University, Dr. Harriet worked in the NHS for over a decade, specializing in pediatric oncology. And I'm a firm believer that it's this experience that gives nutrition advocates like myself and Dr. Harriet a unique perspective of the landscape and the interplay between nutrition and medicine. Dr. Harriet has authored two books. One, Eating During Pregnancy, that she wrote to provide mums with credible information on pregnancy nutrition, and another, Postpartum Nutrition, an Expert's Guide to Eating After a Baby, again written to support new mums and their journey through motherhood and weaning. Dr. Harriet also has a number of virtual courses on her website, the links to which are all on the podcast show notes. Today, this is a topic I'm asked about a lot, so I'm delighted that we can actually talk about this. We're going to be chatting about foods and supplements that may support your fertility. This isn't a cure-all. This is looking at the evidence base and providing you with credible, reasonable suggestions of ways in which to eat to improve fertility. And this is not just for women. This is very much both male and female consideration. Everyone needs to be listening to this kind of information. We talk about carbohydrates and the types that are more beneficial, the importance of sperm nourishment and lifestyle, dairy and soy and their links with fertility, as well as fats and the importance of omega-3, and even the environmental impact on fertility with particular reference to pesticides and pollution. And we do dive into alcohol at a sort of societal level as well as a mechanistic level as to why that's not such a good idea from the perspective of improving your chances of conception, as well as the supplements that you might want to consider. There's also an article to support today's podcast that you can find on the Doctor's Kitchen website, which lists the evidence base used for the recommendations and the foundation for our conversation today. And I hope you find it a useful resource for you and your loved ones. Here is my conversation all to do about eating for fertility with Dr. Harriet Holm. Harriet, thanks so much for joining me on the show. Super excited to talk about the subject with you. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Oh, no, no worries. I mean, you've written some incredible articles for the website and stuff. And I love sort of your work and a bit about your story as well, about how you worked in the NHS, continue to work clinically and to sort of found Nutritium. So I wonder if we could start actually by just exploring your story a bit more and how you became the Healthy Eating Doctor, which is your brand now.
Sure. So I studied medicine at Cambridge. It feels a very long time ago now. And then I did my clinical at UCL, and I've stayed in London really ever since. So I trained as a paediatric trainee, and then I became a paediatric oncology trainee. And then I took some time out to do a PhD on the genetics of osteosarcoma, the rare bone tumour, and really loved that. And then I think it was sort of probably a combination of sort of noting more about the importance of nutrition with the paediatric oncology patients and how tough that is. And also then just really expanding my knowledge of genetics during my PhD and the emerging research on the microbiota and the microbiome. And I think that was the sort of those the things that sort of fueled my interest in nutrition. And the sort of this, I really like the science side of it, how it's really possible, I think, to actually get some evidence-based studies that are replicated in animals and humans, and that although there's a lot of sort of myths around nutrition, there is actually some, you know, fundamental science in there that if you can drill down to that, then you can actually, you know, really work that out and make a positive difference to your life. And I think it's that really, the sort of combination of being a doctor and seeing the importance of long-term health, and also realizing how you can alter that and how you can really moderate that with nutrition, and then looking at the science behind it, the science of the microbiota, the science of the microbiome. I find all that really fascinating. So then I stepped aside from medicine and I then lectured in nutrition. Oh, first of all, I became a registered nutritionist and then I lectured in nutrition.
Important step there, yeah.
And then I was commissioned to write a degree on nutrition, which combines culinary skills. I didn't do that bit, but I did the nutrition and the health side. And it's the first of its type in the country. And it's really aimed at, a lot of chefs. Because I think it's, how are they meant to know what nutritious food is if they don't learn about it and learn the importance and why you think some things are nutritious and not, and some of those myths. So I was really proud of that. And now I've written two books on what to eat during pregnancy and then what to eat after you've had your baby and breastfeeding. I write for you and I write for a couple of other people. And that's a bit about me. I really like science-based nutrition.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's like kind of a whistle-stop tour through like a really expansive career thus far. You kind of skipped over the registered nutritionist bit, and I just want to explore that a little bit more because, you know, you're registered with the AFN. It's sort of like a benchmark for nutritionists in the UK. It demonstrates a clear understanding of the nutrition world. And I think that's a very, very unique proposition that you offer as both someone who has hardline, frontline clinical experience with the understanding of nutrition. So I wonder, how did you become registered and what was your educational experience there?
So for most people, I think the vast majority of people to register with the AFN have to do a specific degree, which then entitles them to become registered with the AFN. But for me, I had a portfolio of evidence, it was about 50 pages, I think I had to do a large portfolio and references that all showed that I had the same knowledge as someone that had done that. So that was through learning what I'd learned at Cambridge with sort of the basic science stuff, the physiology, metabolism, biochemistry, a lot of that. And then what I'd learned on my way through stuff in my PhD, a wide portfolio of evidence, really, and that entitled me to be registered with the AFN. So, yes, I think there are probably not many people that have got a medical degree I'm registered with the AFN and I've got, you know, PhD in genetics. So I guess I'm a little unusual, but it's a nice combination. I feel it kind of gives me, the science helps me to understand all of those studies. You know, I think before I did my, I was an academic clinical fellow, an ACF on the NIHR pathway, and I'd done quite a bit of research on my way through as an academic trainee. And I think although I, you know, published in Blood and, you know, found novel genes, I didn't really understand about the difference between animal models, cellular models, how that translates. And I think it was really only doing my PhD that enabled me to really understand in detail the pros and cons of all those things. And I think as a routine, you know, normal medical trainee without the ACF, I probably would have had even less understanding of that. So I think it puts me in a really privileged position to be able to understand, you know, when I read those papers, what are they actually doing? Does it matter? Why have they chosen this model? Can you extrapolate anything from this model? And then with my clinical training, I can think, oh, well, actually, they've done this in animals, but it doesn't make any difference in humans, or how can we translate it into humans? And then they've had their, you know, obviously it's nutrition based. So that's, you know, the AFN and it, my field now is, you know, concentrating on nutrition and health together.
Yeah, it's a fascinating and really interesting perspective that you're able to glean by looking at those studies. And I don't want to digress too much because I want to get to the topic of eating to improve fertility. But I wonder, given your perspective, where do you think the biggest pitfalls are within nutritional science and the hierarchy of evidence that we have available to us as clinicians that look at nutrition? And where do you think we should be concentrating our efforts if we were to design more nutrition trials that could actually offer us a way of helping people live healthier, happier lives?
I think if you have animal and cellular models, they're quite easy to control, and you can easily get, you know, sort of answers from them. Obviously, they're limited by the fact they're cellular and animal models, but human models for nutrition are so difficult. So I think, you know, clinical trials in nutrition are confounded and biased by so many different things. You know, if you eat organic food, you're probably more likely to go to the gym, you live in a bigger house, you have a bigger garden, you know, all of those things, versus someone who eats, you know, regularly eats processed meat. And it's very stereotypical, but it's probably very true. And how do you get over that? And how do you, you know, make a placebo? How do you do it, sort of blind it? How do you double blind it? How do you, you know, you can easily randomize things, but how do you really work out what's going on? And I think that the problem is with a lot of this is it's not a quick intervention. And this is lifestyle changes. And these are changes that you're only really going to reap the benefit of many, many years later. And so just an intervention of a dietary change for a month or two or 6 months or even a couple of years, how do you look at the outpoint? You know, what's the outcome measure? And they're either very subjective outcome measures or they're objective outcome measures, which will take years into the future. If you sort of look at, you know, cardiovascular risk, you're going to have to wait, you know, quite a long time. And so I think it's really difficult to do these studies that are powered enough to understand them, that you know, and that they're costly as well. You know, going to be a huge cost. Who's going to do them? Is it going to be a clinical, you know, research group, which is going to cost them a lot of money? They're going to have to get charitable funding to do it, or is it going to be a company looking to see if they can find an association? And then, of course, you've got the whole problem of, you know, negative results aren't published, are they? No one knows. You know, it's difficult enough to get a publication, let alone negative results. No one's interested in negative results. So then you have that bias. So I think it's the clinical studies that are really challenging, really challenging.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, I'm often sort of met with this sort of cynical view of big pharma and how everything is a corporate conspiracy to dampen down nutrition and actually promote pharmaceuticals or nutraceuticals even. But it's like you said, it's inherently very difficult to do nutrition studies. You can't blind someone's diet compared to another one. It's very expensive. And the mechanisms are multifactorial as well. So when you're eating food or eating according to a dietary pattern, you're having an influence on multiple different biological pathways, which is great on the surface of it, because it means, you know, it can explain a whole bunch of observations that we see. But on at the crux of it, it's very hard to explain and go into depth of the mechanisms. It's much easier to, you know, give someone a placebo and then a pharmaceutical pill and test those, because it maintains sort of the highest standard of research according to the gold standard.
And also that, you know, most clinical studies are now are so biomarker driven. And if you've got a drug and it acts on target A and you know what the biomarker is, it's so much easier to give the intervention, measure the biomarker, and you've got a really nice, quick, easy, well, it's not cheap, but it's an awful lot cheaper, quicker study where you can power with far fewer people than, you know, if you're doing this and you don't know what the biomarkers are, or there are a range of biomarkers, you don't know quite how the biomarkers relate. And then you've also got now, you know, think of the sort of the microbiota is even changing, or, you know, is now thought to have an effect on chemotherapeutic sensitivity. You know, how do you account for that as well? Do you give everyone a course of antibiotics, wipe the microbiota out, and then, you know, repopulate them with a fecal transplant to know? So there are just so many factors. I think it's so difficult.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to just stick to first principles, I think, when it comes to nutrition, which is exactly kind of what we're going to be talking about today when talking about eating to improve fertility. I wonder, sort of my first question is, where did your interest sort of lie when it comes to fertility and postpartum nutrition? Is it from your own experience? Is it from colleagues? Or is it just something that you naturally gravitated toward?
I think probably a bit of the fact that I'm female and have been through all of these things myself. And also I guess sort of a gravity towards women's health in that regard. But I think mainly as a mum and a, you know, mum of two children now, an awful lot of this information, I just didn't feel it was available when I was going through it. And I didn't have problems conceiving, but I certainly didn't conceive, you know, on the you know, first try. And I did look into all of this at the time, and I found it, you know, really, even with all of those sort of, you know, skill set, I found it not easy to navigate. And I thought, well, if I'm finding that, then I'm sure an awful lot of other people are as well. And the same things, you know, when I had my children, I kind of thought, you know, I'd have a fairly good understanding being a, you know, pediatrician, but it was so much more to it. And there's so much, you know, I didn't realise at the time about, you know, needing more, you know, calcium when you're breastfeeding, you know, those sort of things about looking after your long-term, you know, health as a mum. And so it's only really now I feel I'm in a position to help other people and to give them that information so that they're empowered to, you know, look after themselves. And also there's just so much, there's so many myths, you know. I know in Australia at the moment, bone broth is being touted as better than breast milk. And I just...
Really?
Yes. I mean, I find it astonishing. Way. Yes. So...
Oh, my word.
That is really worrying. Me. Yeah. And so I just think, I really just come back to, I want it to provide science-backed, you know, evidence-based information for people so that they can just look through it and it's not biased. I'm not trying to sell them a supplement, or, you know, I'm just giving them the information so they can choose then whether they want to follow it or which bits they want to follow. I feel there needs to be more evidence-based in the world, you know, there needs to be.
Well, I think, you know, partly, and to turn the lens on ourselves, it's kind of like, well, we're not taught nutrition to a significant degree during our medical school training, and when patients sort of look for information, you have this huge vacuum, and unfortunately that's filled by a lot of erroneous players that will spread information. I mean, I'm still in a bit of shock about the whole bone broth versus breast milk stuff, given how nutritious breast milk is. It's incredible. But
also that bone broth does not impart special features. It hasn't, you know, the immune cells from the bone marrow are all killed and denatured when you cook it. Yeah. And yeah. It's got risk of toxins leaching out of the bones as you cook it for so long. I just find it astonishing. And
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Also, I think it's those people that, you know, if you're struggling to breastfeed and you're desperate, you're going to look for answers. If you're trying to have a baby, you'll do anything, you know, you're desperate. And I think almost people play on those, you know, those fears and worries about it. And I find that really sad, actually. I find it, you know, a sad state of affairs.
When there's money to be made, people will stoop to levels to sell a product. So unfortunately, but that's our job today, to rectify the situation. So I wonder if we could start off with the landscape of fertility as it stands at the moment. What are the sort of success rates for a couple? And are there any features of our sort of Western landscape, both from an environmental point of view and a food point of view, that might be having an impact on fertility rates?
So about 80% of couples will conceive within a year. And if you haven't, then that's a good time to speak to your doctor. If you've got, you know, known problems already, then maybe speak to them a bit earlier. But about 10 to 25% of couples who are trying for a baby will have some difficulty. And those subfertility factors are spread pretty evenly between men and women. So men are just as important as this. I think a lot of the time they get forgotten. What they're eating and their diet, you know, will play just as a huge role on gay meat, you know, healthy gay meat, quality gay meat production as it does for women. But I think certainly it's a time when it's really stressful and you might be more inclined to therefore eat those, you know, hyper palatable foods that are high in sugar, high in fat, that maybe aren't quite so good for you. So and it's totally understandable if you're feeling stressed, you have that cortisol release that drives you to eat those hyperpalatable foods, you know, inhibits your satiety feeling, so you eat more. And that, you know, but then it's, you know, how can you try to contain that and then eat healthily to support your fertility? And I'm certainly not saying this is going to, you know, get everyone pregnant by any means. This is just about supporting you trying as opposed to a cure. So but there are a number of things you can do. So carbohydrates are...
Before we get onto carbs, actually, I just want to clarify what we mean by gay meat production, because I can imagine there's a few listeners who are not privy to the medical terminology. So I'm going to stop you every time I feel there's some medical jargon. I'm going to clarify it, if not for my own benefit, then for the listeners.
So gay meats are the sperm and the eggs, and that's what I'm talking about when you gay meat production. So obviously men are producing many, many more, and women are producing, you know, one or maybe two or sometimes more a month. But gay meats for women take a lot longer to produce or to mature, whereas they mature quicker in males. But probably a diet for 3 months is what you need to be thinking about changing your diet for about a 3 month period in order to see any benefit. Really, it's not a quick fix.
Brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, just to reiterate what you already said, you know, this isn't a list of cure-all foods that is going to make everyone super fertile, but it's definitely giving couples the best chance at laying the foundation for improved fertility, as guided by the evidence that we'll dive into. And just with my GP hat on, just to remind listeners that, you know, 80% after a year, those are good numbers, but you have to be having regular sexual intercourse for this to happen. I've had a number of instances where, you know, unfortunately couples have come in after a year, but they haven't been having sex as often as they should be, which is a couple of times a week, if not more. So yeah, just to clarify that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were talking about carbs. So this is a common thing that I'm asked about in terms of the quality of carbs and the amount of carbs and stuff. How does that impact fertility?
So carbohydrates, when they're broken down into saccharides, little tiny rings. And those are your, you know, your glucose and your sucrose. And the bigger the carbohydrate molecule, the harder it is to break it down. So the longer it is, the sort of lower and slower the rise in glucose. And that puts less pressure on your body. And that is your sort of marker of insulin sensitivity or resistance. And that may influence ovarian function. And certainly in women with PCOS, they've got, when you improve their insulin sensitivity and they have a lower carbohydrate diet, that can help them to ovulate. So if you can change, you know, this is really the basis of a healthy diet anyway. If you can change from refined carbohydrates to whole grain carbohydrates, you know, that's going to really support your body anyway. And not just the fact that you've got that insulin sensitivity, but also they've got, you know, nutrients in them. And that as they're, you know, harder to break down, some of them, more of them make it to the colon where they, you know, feed and, you know, you support your microbiota as those prebiotics. So they're good from a number of points, really. And that that antioxidant, anti-inflammatory, you know, microbiota supporting effect has been shown to have beneficial effects on glucose metabolism. And there was one study, the EARTH study, that showed that if you have a higher level of those whole grains in a preconception diet, it was actually associated with a higher probability of live birth.
Oh, wow. And was there any explanation other than what you've just brought up there about why whole grains in particular might have that beneficial effect? Is it something to do with the sort of extra antioxidant load or the extra sort of phytonutrients that you find in the high fiber whole grains?
I think it's a combination of those, that like the extra antinutrients, and the fact that we know that refined sugars can irritate and don't support or help your microbiota, and that if your microbiota is not happy, that increases your risk of chronic inflammation. So you can see then how it has sort of wider role. If you've got the antioxidant features, the prebiotics, you've got healthy microbiota, lower levels of inflammation, that's going to help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's so many, like we said at the start of this, there's so many potential pathways as to why this might be helping. And I suppose this is all just hypotheses, but it is interesting to note that everything that we talk about and we're going to talk about is really the foundation of a generally healthy diet anyway. But it's interesting to have these conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Dairy is something I'm asked about a lot. I know during my master's in nutritional medicine, we had a whole lecture on iodine, and one of the lecturers was really hot on dairy being a very important source of iodine, which has a whole bunch of beneficial effects and important effects, particularly on thyroid metabolism. But dairy and fertility, is there a positive or negative association? What do we need to know about this ingredient in our diets?
So just to go back to iodine, I think iodine is a forgotten nutrient, and loads of people don't realize that they need it. And especially if you know you sort of dabble in the, oh, I'll go dairy free, and you don't eat fish or eggs, where, you know, your main iodine sources are, you don't realize that you're going to miss out on that. But the one good thing is that there are a number of plant-based milks now that are fortifying with iodine, which I think is really fantastic. So dairy, there's no real evidence that dairy affects fertility. And the same with soy, really, that, you know, So there's no reason to stop dairy or soy while you're trying for a baby. In the same way that I think, you know, probably dairy is a really good source of calcium and protein and iodine, and you can choose to have it in your diet in limited quantities, like the Mediterranean style diet, or you can choose to have, you know, those plant-based alternatives, same with the sort of, you know, general healthy diet.
Yeah, just to reiterate, actually, I think it is important if you are looking for plant-based alternatives to look for those fortified milks. As one of the main sources of iodine in our diets, those who eat all animal products, is milk, because of the iodinization process in the agricultural farming methods. But it is also found in sort of eggs and fish as well. So, and it's particularly good for, you know, well, it's important to maintain adequate iodine levels for fertility.
And also while breastfeeding as well. And and the other thing, I think that people tend to think organic food is better, and they'll go out and they'll buy the organic plant-based milk, not realizing that it's not fortified. And I think that's, that's a really important thing to highlight. If you're dairy-free or plant-based and that's your main source of calcium and iodine, always ignore the organic ones and go for the ones that are fortified.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, let's talk about meat and fish, actually, because I think given that the popularity of 100% plant-based is on the rise, I think we have to, you know, really be pragmatic when it comes to the potential impact on fertility as well and what that could entail.
Yeah, so meat and fish during fertility. So it's omega-3 is really important for, you know, cellular function, the membrane formation, and it's important for OOS. It's really important for gamete, so those sperm and their eggs. So eating fish is important. Eating that omega-3, the oily fish, if you can do that, if that's part of your diet, or eating those seeds and nuts, which, you know, the plant-based sources of them. So carry on doing that and do that a couple of times a week until you get pregnant, and then drop it down to sort of one serving a week of oily fish. And then meat. So there's no association, there's no real evidence that meat decreases your fertility. But I think if you sort of look at sort of the bigger picture here, you know, you probably want to be eating mainly plant-based. That's where the evidence is, with, you know, limited meat. And that if you're going to eat meat, then eat quality over quantity and try to avoid processed meat. And we know that processed meat is good at quality evidence that if it's preserved by smoking and nitrites, that those chemicals in it do increase your long-term risk of bowel cancer. So avoid those where possible. Look for small quantity, quality meat, quality over quantity. And then keep eating those oily fish, which are so important, or your chia seeds, walnuts, you know, those things instead.
Yeah, definitely. I want to double click on omega-3, actually, because it is certainly something that has grown in importance across a number of different fields of nutrition and medicine. But I want to weigh in on your genetic experience here. Is there a difference between certain phenotypes, i.e. certain people, based on their genes and their ability to absorb omega-3 long chain fats from omega-3 sources that come from plants like walnuts and chia seeds? Is there a difference from depending on cultural backgrounds or ethnicity?
That's a really great question. I don't know that, actually, but I'm sure there will be, as in I'm sure that there are. You know, the more we understand about genetics, the more we understand about, you know, the sort of the SNPs, the single nucleotide polymorphisms, those tiny changes that aren't mutations, but will all impact and probably infer a slightly different phenotype. So I imagine there's a slightly different there's probably a range of phenotypic effect, and that will undoubtedly change every aspect of our makeup, including, you know, omega-3 transport, metabolism, and all of those things. I'm sure from the sort of understanding that we have of genetics, it's probably also modulated an environmental factor where you can switch it on and off with methylation. And that's probably, we don't fully understand how that works, but things like smoking, chemical exposure, UV sunlight, all those other things, you know, will have an effect on as well. So, and in some ways that's quite nice, as it shows that there's some plasticity. You might be able to change things according to your environment, but also there is, you know, there's the negative side to that as well, that if your environmental setup isn't as great, then you may be having a negative connotations there. But I don't know the specifics of omega-3 genetic, you know, phenotype. Genotypes.
Yeah. And I caught myself there using some jargon. So phenotype being the physical manifestation of your genes, essentially. I will definitely look into that, because I had a nutrigenetic test a number of years ago. I was given it for free, and it isolated one of these SNPs in it, and it suggested that my ability to convert short chain omega-3 fats that we find in walnut and chia is actually heightened into long chain, which is beneficial, particularly if you are plant-based. But it's definitely one to... Do you have any opinion on those nutrigenetic tests as they stand at the moment? I know there's a vast range of different companies, some who are responsible and some that are less responsible, but without naming names, do you have a general opinion on them?
There is a huge range of quality, undoubtedly. And then I think it also comes down to what you do with it. To back up, if you think of like your DNA as the coding for your body, and that's like, I don't know, if you were to write, you know, like your PhD thesis, that contains everything in it. It's a huge volume. It's got 24,000 genes. And then if you break that down into to genes, so that's like chapters of the book. And then if you think of like a mutation, might be, you know, like cutting out a sentence, and then you look at the SNP, so those are single nucleotide polymorphisms. Those are just like maybe the punctuation. And so all those tests are looking at are actually the SNPs, so those little tiny changes, the sort of, you know, the single nucleotide base changes. And the information you can get from that, while it is information, it is limited because you're only able to really say, well, there's an association. In some ways, you can look at the mechanism and understand the mechanism, but a lot of it is sort of, you know, an association. If you have this, you might have an association of that. And I think some of them are really helpful, like vitamin D metabolism is really useful, because if you have low vitamin D and you have specific SNPs in the so alterations in the genes which transport metabolize vitamin D, you know that you need to have quite huge doses of vitamin D in order to keep it in the normal range. So that can be really helpful. But I think there are an awful lot of other genes which are looked at, like the MTHFR gene, which has got no clinical significance, and an awful lot of amazing stuff has been published about that gene, which I'm always amazed by. And I think actually then if you've got someone that's selling to you and then selling you a whole pile of different supplements off the back of it, then I think that's really worrying. If you've done it to find out a bit more about your genetics, your possible associations of risk, because that's what it is, you know, it's just possible associations of risk, then it can be quite interesting, can shed light on the vitamin D. But that's about as far as it goes at the moment, I think. And I think you need to be quite cautious about who's doing it, why are they doing it, and, you know, what are they trying to sell you off the back of it? Is it a whole pile of their supplements? Is it that you need to be having more, you know, all of these B vitamins and specific type of folate, you know, because there's very limited evidence for any of that. And so I think you need to be cautious. In the same way, it's like when people say, oh, I need to have all my hormones done because I need to balance my hormones. And, you know, these sort of nebulous terms which are sort of banded around, they're really marketing terms, you know, I'm going to balance my hormones. You can't balance your hormones, and, you know, having a hormone test is not going to help you most of the time. And these nutrigenetic tests have a role. I think they will increase, and it will be far more information will be available, and they'll, you know, be much more interesting and much more informative. But at the moment, I think they have a limited place and they give limited information, and they certainly can't tell you, you know, a prescriptive diet based on your genetics, you should eat, you know, cabbage, potatoes. They're not going to tell you that. And if you find someone that tells you that, then ignore them.
Yeah, there's certainly red flags there, I think, whenever you see a product associated with a complementary product, where the two are intertwined to sort of capitalize on people's fear of being deficient. I think you're right about the nebulous terms, and that there's quite a few ones out there, like boosting immunity, superfoods is the classic one, and balancing hormones, all of which don't really mean anything. You can kind of forgive the public for kind of falling into these traps, like, oh, I need to balance my hormones because I'm going through the menopause and they need to be balanced, sort of thing. But like you said, that there's no, that just doesn't make sense to you know, as an action to balance your hormones. But that isn't to say nutrition and even to an extent targeted supplementation may have a beneficial impact on your health outcomes and well-being.
Absolutely. And a classic example of that is PCOS, where, you know, your diet can really affect your hormones, but that doesn't mean that you're balancing them, and blood tests, you know, are going to give you some information, but it's not a way of, you know, you can't eat food X and balance that. So I think, and absolutely, I see as, you know, a consumer, why it'd be really appealing. And, you know, if I need to balance my hormones, it's going to help me, I'm going to feel great, or these, you know, I totally understand it. So I certainly understand why it's done, and I certainly don't judge anyone that, you know, feels that you should do that or want to do that, because I completely understand why you would. And it would be lovely if you could just eat a superfood and you'd feel great. And I totally get why, especially with COVID, why you'd want to, you know, boost your immune system and fight off COVID and not get ill. Whereas, you know, it's those terms are just really marketing terms. So,
One to watch out for. Let's go back to omega-3, because I know this is a very popular sort of topic, but it's definitely got an important role in, like you said, the production of sperm. What other sort of roles does it have through the perspective of both male and female fertility?
Yeah, so it's really important for females as well during the sort of egg maturation and early embryo development. And also omega-3 are really important as precursors for a number of important hormones, and those play a vital role in implantation and the maintenance of pregnancy. And there was a mouse study as well that found that omega-3 delayed ovarian aging, and that been replicated in humans. And going back to that Earth study I mentioned before, they found that if you increase omega-3 through supplementation, that you can increase clinical pregnancy and live birth rates as well. So omega-3 is really important. It's important for, you know, your long-term health, and even more so during fertility. And whether you get that from the omega-3 or plant-based, you know, trying to increase your omega-3-6 ratio, you know, is really important. And just in general, eating a sort of westernized diet, that's often, you know, reverse that omega-3-6 ratio. So you're more likely to be getting omega-6 from those animal saturated fat sources, and less likely to be having those omega-3 sources. So if you can try to reverse that, eat those sources, that will, you know, support your long-term health and support your fertility.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many different ways in which this diet is going to be supporting overall well-being, which is why I find these kind of conversations so validating for, you know, just changing your diet overall. Not only is it going to impact potentially your ability to conceive, but also, you know, your cardiovascular health, your risk of dementia, etc. I wonder if there are sort of that there's overlapping features with those who are down the path of assisted reproductive technologies and assistance with conception. Is there a certain sort of dietary pattern, or do the things that we've talked about already also play a role for those couples?
So I think that a lot of the research that we've got for just couples trying in general has come from those assisted reproduction therapies. So that's where it's much easier to get those outcome measures, to measure live birth, to, you know, do an interventional study. If you're doing that, it's a lot more controlled. So a lot of this evidence does come from that. And certainly if you're going through those techniques at the moment, that, you know, these things will support that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we talked a bit about the environment in terms of pollution, perhaps exposure to agricultural chemicals, pesticides, etc. Do we have any sort of knowledge or understanding about the role that they could be playing in a negative role with fertility?
Yeah, so There is emerging evidence actually about the role of pesticides, and I think that's why a lot of people, if you go for IVF, you're advised to eat an organic diet. And while the chemicals are safe, or thought to be safe for us, and are small levels, there is some evidence which is quite difficult to ignore, that they, you know, in small quantities, pesticides can have an effect. So there was a study that looked at men who ate the highest amount of fruit and vegetable, because they're often, you know, the ones that have got pesticides on them, and that those who ate more fruit and vegetables were associated with a higher percentage of abnormal sperm. Now, there may well be, you know, confounders in that and bias. If you're eating more fruit and vegetables, you may well be eating a healthier diet in general. But then you shouldn't have abnormal sperm. So I think it's quite hard to ignore that. And I think it's an easy change to make. Really, the only downside of organic food is the cost. There isn't really an a downside otherwise. And if that's something that, you know, you can afford, then certainly while, you know, you're trying for a baby and the sort of, you know, the cellular changes matter, so, you know, more important than ever when you're having a baby, you know, that that one sperm, that one egg are the key, you know, are what's going to get you a baby or not. That, you know, that just for 3 months or while you're trying, if you could swap over to an organic diet, I think that would be helpful. And certainly if you can't, wash your fruit and vegetables really well, because, you know, they're going to be mainly on the outside of them, and give them a good scrub.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. There's a whole bunch of like DIY fruit and veg scrubbing mixtures and rubs that you can get, I think, with like a bit of vinegar or something like that, to really scrub your vegetables. And I think you're right, you know, it's getting harder to ignore the growing concerns, I think, around pesticide use on fruits and vegetables. To the point where, I mean, I don't get too caught up about organic versus conventional, like when I'm out or when we used to go to restaurants, let's say. But if possible and where possible, I try and choose organic, because like you said, the only downside is the cost, and there are certainly environmental gains to be had from organic produce as well. Which is kind of shifting my own personal consumer habits.
And also with milk now, this is the IGF-1 seen in milk. So that's the insulin-like growth factor, which is seen more in non-organic milk. There are, you know, emerging studies that may well be linked with, you know, like prostate cancer. So I just think if you can have organic, you know, while there's no difference probably in the nutritional value of it, you know, an organic carrot is no different or has marginal difference to a non-organic carrot. It's those added bits that come with it, those, you know, the pesticide residue or the IGF-1 in milk that, but maybe long-term, you know, there's a huge difference as well, I think, between, you know, absolute safety in a general population or, you know, at a population level, versus, you know, an individual level, especially if you're trying to get pregnant. And I think there's still a lot more research to be done and a lot more information to know, really.
Yeah, yeah. Alcohol. I'm probably speaking more to the male audience when talking about alcohol and fertility, but as this sort of tend to sideline themselves, or perhaps they're sidelined by their partner when it comes to changes to support fertility. Is there any sort of evidence to suggest that we should be certainly drinking less, or maybe not at all?
Yes. So, you know, alcohol in general, we should really be drinking less. You know, alcohol is the number one risk factor for breast cancer, other than genetics, obviously. But you know, in general, we should all be drinking less. And certainly when you're trying to conceive, there's evidence that it reduces your fertility, reduces your time to conception, reduces your quality of those gametes, you know, those and it reduces the quality of embryo quality as well. So even once they've fertilized and you've got your embryo, that it decreases implantation in people going through IVF. So there's good evidence that you should try and avoid it if you're able to.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely one of those subjects, I think, that perhaps in 50 years' time, we're probably going to look back at our current society and the way we sort of, with in perpetuity, allow alcohol advertising across, you know, things like the Premier League, in supermarkets and all the rest of it. Like, oh my God, how on earth did we allow this to happen, considering the associations with not just physical and mental problems, but also the wider implications of things like abuse and, you know, poverty and addiction. You know, it's a hugely, hugely problematic substance that we allow in society without many restrictions.
I think it will be the news. I agree entirely. I think we'll look back on it in the same way that we did with smoking. And now, you know, how lovely is it to be able to go out to a restaurant and, you know, you choose if you want, you know, you don't have to put up with other people's smoke. You know, if you want to smoke, go outside. I think that that's really refreshing for the non-smokers of the world. I wonder if alcohol will ever get to that stage. I don't think we will. I think alcohol will probably always be a social thing. But I think certainly in the way, you know, the vegan trend has come in from the cold and is now really mainstream. I think that probably a lot more people will be, you know, alcohol free. I certainly remember, so I had meningitis 20 years ago when I was a student.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And so I gave up alcohol for a year afterwards. I had you know, issues afterwards. And it was such a sort of, you know, a difficult thing socially 20 years ago, you know, not to go on a night out at you know, medical school not to drink. But now I think that's probably a lot more socially acceptable if you don't drink. And, you know, I think that's great. I think, you know, so I think the world's, that's changing for better.
I definitely see similarities with the smoking industry. You know, you're seeing a lot of consolidation around big smoking corporations like Philip Morris and the likes, hoovering up those electronic cigarette companies because they see the trend towards non-smoking. And I think the same thing is happening within the drinks industry, which is why you have big giants like Diageo buying up smaller companies that are doing non-alcoholic spirits, some of which I really like, actually, the non-spirit, the zero alcohol spirits, because they give you that feeling of socializing when you're out, but not the hangover the next day. And actually, I've admitted this in the podcast recently about how I was drinking definitely a lot more last year during 2020 when I was coming back from work as a way to sort of unwind. And I mean, that definitely had negative connotations for me, the way I felt the next day. My weight definitely fluctuated. My mood was definitely, you know, up and down and stuff. So I think there's definitely that trend towards massively reducing or completely removing alcohol in its entirety that that I welcome when you look at the grander impacts of alcohol in society.
No, I agree entirely. I think it's a great direction that we're traveling in with alcohol.
Yeah, and the trends as well. They're pretty cool to see, like, you know, 0% beer and all this kind of stuff. So yeah. Anyway, we digress.
Absolutely. I don't drink very much, and I couldn't tolerate a hangover anymore. You know, I just, no. That's my main thing. My kids are enough of, you know, I couldn't be up with them and up in the morning and, you know, have a hangover as well. I just,
yeah. Exactly, yeah. Maybe it's just a trend that happens when you go into your late 30s and 40s that, you know.
there's too much advertising that sort of, you know, mum, it's 1 o'clock time. Yeah, and, you know, those things. And I get that, you know, after a long day, you might want to have a glass of wine or, you know, beer or whatever. But, but there's so many other different ways of relaxing now that I think that maybe, you know, we're a bit more tuned into, which is good.
Definitely. We're sport for choice, I think, in terms of activities, of things that we can do. Maybe not right now during a lockdown period. But, you know, there are a whole bunch of other activities that we should be encouraging to sort of wind down rather than looking at the bottom of a bottle or the top of the bottle that turns into bottom of the bottle. Anyway, we talked a bit about omega-3 and the interesting fact about the Earth study finding that, you know, omega-3 supplementation was related to an increase of live birth rate. Are there supplements that you think are worth considering for couples who are trying to conceive?
So certainly folate. Every woman should be on, you know, preconception folate from as soon as you're thinking about trying to get pregnant, right up until 12 weeks. And most people should be on, 400 milligrams of folate. If you've got epilepsy or you're have special risk factors, then you might need to be on a higher dose. But there's good evidence as well that maybe folate might help men, actually, and it's increased their sperm count and sperm quality. So I think maybe if you're struggling, might be something to try. You know, it's obviously really safe. It's safe enough for women to take during pregnancy. It reduces their risk of spina bifida, so that's neural tube defects, where the neural tube doesn't form completely at the base of the spine. So you know, if it's safe enough for women to take, it's safe enough for men to take as well, and might actually help you. Equally, you know, as a male, you could also just, you know, increase folate in your diet. So it's like broccoli, green leafy vegetables, kidney beans, fortified foods, chickpeas. So those kind of things. So certainly folate, definitely for women, consider it for men. And then vitamin D, everyone should, you know, the sort of NHS guidance, everyone should be taking vitamin D during the autumn and winter months. You try to keep it in the normal range. And then there's sort of lots of other different supplements. And I think the evidence for these is a lot more sketchy. So they're antioxidants, that's like things like coenzyme Q10 and vitamin E. They've been shown that they may help male infertility, but much less positive effect in women. And I think there's some evidence to support them, but I think really a lot more research I think is really needed, because a lot of the studies are quite low quality. So I personally would you know, I wouldn't be rushing to supplement with those. I think if you can increase your antioxidant levels within your diet, so that's, you know, fruit, vegetables, whole grains, and that is, you know, is certainly the first step. And then, you know, maybe further down the line, then maybe consider those depending on you know, your position.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are vitamin. I mean, I take 2,000 international units of vitamin D3 every day. I struggle to push my vitamin D levels high, and it's most likely because of my skin color and my ability to convert to vitamin D3 in the skin. But I'm no longer surprised when I see vitamin D levels in the low 20s these days. And I try and get people to get that sweet spot of at least around 40 to 50. There's a bit of a controversy around what is the optimal level for vitamin D, but, you know, my sort of pragmatic thinking is that it's very hard to push your vitamin D levels up to a toxic level unless you're literally taking like 10,000 IU a day, which would be very expensive to do. Do you have any ideas about, like, any suggestions on the amounts that people should supplement with?
So I think vitamin D is not straightforward, to be honest, because I think it's quite hard to know how much you should be taking without a blood test, because you don't really know whether how much you need. So without sort of swamping the NHS and everyone clamouring to get a vitamin D test, I think, you know, for most people, probably 400 international units, which is the recommended dose, will be enough. But there will be people like you and me. So I've got totally different complexion to you, but I know that I'm a poor metabolizer and transporter of vitamin D. So I have to take 10,000 units a day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I'm one of those people. And so are my children. And we know that vitamin D is a really important, you know, cofactor in many genes. Yeah. It's even been associated with lung function. So if you look at patients with COPD and cystic fibrosis, an independent marker of lung function is vitamin D status. And I think it is important, and it's important that we get enough. So how do you know if you're one of those people? The only way you can tell if you've got low vitamin D, despite what you're doing, is really to have a blood test. And then you can titrate and know, well, you know, okay, I'm taking 400 units, but my international units, but my, you know, vitamin D levels are low. You'll know that you need to take a bit more. So I don't think I think otherwise we're just treating it blind a lot of the time. And that's not easy. And also I think, you know, maybe a few years ago, if I'd seen someone with low vitamin D levels and they'd said that they were taking them, I might have wondered how much they took them. Whereas now I think I'd think, oh, right, you're taking them, but probably you're a poor transporter and metabolizer, so you need to take more. So I think we've got a lot more information, and that's that one key thing where I think the nutrigenetics is really actually a really helpful test just to know about your vitamin D, not so much the rest of it, but certainly vitamin D. And that gives you that information to know that you do need to take more. So And while certainly not saying with fertility that if you supplement, you're more likely to get pregnant, I think, you know, everyone should really be keeping their vitamin D level in the normal range, you know, for long-term health. And that will support, you know, all of the other parameters of health, including fertility.
Do you have any opinion on sort of the home blood testing kits that are, again, more available these days? Because I'm conscious that people who don't want to waste, for want of a better term, NHS time by going in to check their levels just so they're in the optimal range when they don't actually have symptoms suggestive of severe vitamin D deficiency. Do you think that there's a role for those companies in a private manner?
So I think there probably is, but again, there's a huge variety of them and a huge difference, not in the quality of the blood test, which I think is, you know, pretty standardized and good. It's who's supplying it and what is their reason. Are they doing it so that they can, you know, not just test vitamin D, but they can test a whole panel of things, most of which, you know, potentially meaningless? Or you know, when I was a doctor, I lived very much by the sort of philosophy of only really doing investigations that would change my management, not just out of interest, but to change the management. You know, if a child came in and they were sick, are they clinically sick? So why am I doing blood tests on them? Yeah. I can tell they're sick. I don't need a blood test to tell me they're sick. I might need a blood test to tell me something else. So in the same way that, you know, you could measure all manner of things in your body and have an interesting result. Might be of interest to know all of those things, but it's not actually going to change management. So I think if it's vitamin D and, you know, there's some sensible reasoning behind it, or, you know, you're just doing that and you've got someone that can help support you with knowing what dose to take, that's great. If you're being sold a whole panel of meaningless blood tests, then I'd be cautious about it, to be honest. It's back to those balancing hormone, you know, or find out all about your body. You probably don't really need to know any of that information. But vitamin, just knowing the vitamin D, having someone, you know, a registered nutritionist or a doctor that can help, you know, titrate those levels with you and tell you how much you should probably be taking, I think is helpful. And there is a role for it. Certainly, I think, you know, the NHS probably needs, you know, it's only a finite resource and needs to be focusing on those people with, you know, symptomatic levels of, you know, vitamin D or, you know, other things. But and then I should caveat it and say that vitamin D is a fat soluble vitamin. So your body stores it. It is 100% possible to take too much and get vitamin D toxicity. So if you don't know that you're a poor transporter of it, you 100% should not be taking 10,000 units a day. Yeah. You should be on, you know, much lower. You should be on 400. So, you know, there's caution with all of that as well.
It's definitely a difficult topic, isn't it? And I think, again, you've exemplified why it's really advantageous to have that clinical perspective, that NHS perspective combined with nutrition and sort of delving into the private world of testing and investigations, because it's been drilled into my head from day one. If it doesn't change management, why on earth are you doing that test? And there are definitely cost saving advantages with that methodology, but it's also saving unnecessary investigation, unnecessary pain and inconvenience to the patient, and focusing on what really changes and pushes the needle. So, you know, I think we could all learn from that experience. And that's definitely something that has stayed with me whenever, you know, giving out information online, because it's very easy to dive into that biohacking optimization at any cost kind of field, which again has a lot of erroneous players and can spread misinformation about what we should really be looking at when it comes to our bodies.
Absolutely. And then also I think you sort of end up with you end up with this sort of panel of blood tests, and one of them might be slightly abnormal, and then you're kind of well what do I do with that now? There weren't any symptoms, you know, it's not abnormal enough to do anything about it. It's just, you know, and it's, you probably never needed that worry. You never needed that blood test. You never needed any of that information. So I agree with you entirely. And I think probably doing it more from a pediatric, you know, child's perspective, you 100% wouldn't be just doing some blood tests on someone just to have some interesting answers. But you might be more likely to do that, I think, on, you know, an adult in A&E or back when I was training, you know, in A&E, probably nearly 20 years ago, not quite 15 years ago. It might have been no more. Everyone had that needle in, everyone had those baseline bloods. And, you know, I think it's Things are changing. That's, you know, it's really great. You've got that, you know, evidence base. What's the management decisions? So I think it's good, and we should, you know, use that through all walks of life, really. Not just medicine, nutrition.
Definitely, you know, lending on your pediatric experience, you are much less likely to stick a needle into a child and, you know, cause massive aggravation to a kid. So you're going to be a lot more sort of reliant on your clinical skills, looking at symptoms, taking a good history, than we are with patients. You know, as soon as people come to A&E, they expect a blood test almost, which is, you know, sometimes, yeah, it takes a bit of explaining as to why we're not just taking blood. It's not because we're trying to save money, it's because we're trying to save you time. And yes, we are trying to save the NHS at the same time as well. So I want to just touch on some of the foods, because, you know, like I said earlier, it just kind of matches perfectly over a very well-balanced Mediterranean style way of eating when you're trying to eat for, you know, adequate levels of zinc and omega-3 and iron, all the rest of it. But particularly from folate, you mentioned a few ingredients. What were the ones that you would say that are particularly important from that perspective?
So folates, like green leafy vegetables, chickpeas, broccoli, kidney beans, and then foods fortified with folate. So breakfast cereals are, you know, a good example of that. So they're fortified with folate normally. So those are some examples.
And you've got some examples of quality fats, like certain nuts and seeds. Are there any ones that stick out to you?
So like walnut is high in omega-3. They're, you know, good. But I think this comes down to, you know, not just having like a fixed diet. I'm only going to eat walnuts because they're the highest in omega-3. I think I'm going to have, you know, a range of different things, because otherwise it's restrictive, it's boring, and you need all those different things, in the same way that we say to eat the rainbow. All of those different colours are different antioxidant compounds, and that's why we say it, because, you know, they've all got slightly different properties. So I think eat a range, and, you know, have different nuts, have different seeds, you know, mix it up, keep it interesting. Otherwise you'll get very, very bored, and that's not what you want. And then you'll, you know, go back, and, you know, that's the basis of a diet, really, isn't it? Where you restrict, it's difficult to restrict, you get bored, you get fed up, you crave the things you can't have, and then you just abandon it. And I think these are really more about long-term sustainable lifetime changes, where you're changing your diet for life, and you're not bored, you're not restricting anything, you're just trying to make those healthy choices and eating a range of different foods and doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, my sort of suggestions for people is to use diversity as your go-to strategy, because if you diversify your diet across different categories of food that include things like quality fats from nuts and seeds, and even, you know, cold-pressed oils, are lots of different colors from different plant-based materials. You have a largely plant-based diet. You have a lot of fiber from beans and nuts and legumes. You're going to be getting a whole range of those different micronutrients, macronutrients, and phytonutrients that are so pivotal for, yes, fertility, but also a whole bunch of other risk reduction strategies for other conditions.
Absolutely. And if you restrict and you cut food groups out, you're a lot less likely to meet your micronutrient and macronutrient needs. So I think the key is diversity and choice and healthy choice and long-term, you know, enjoyment of food.
I really hope you enjoyed today's podcast. It is a minefield of a subject, but I think we can reasonably suggest a few key things that we touched on today's conversation. It's largely a Mediterranean style diet, but it doesn't necessarily need to be Mediterranean flavored. You can still get good quality fats in the form of nuts and seeds, a variety of largely plants in your diet, good high fiber whole grains, as well as a good mixture of different omega-3 rich ingredients, and yes, some supplements through a variety of different dietary cuisine. So, you know, we can create curries with lots of good quality fats in them. You can create tray bakes and Middle Eastern dishes with beans and different lentils and different flavors. So do have a think about the wider application of the things that we talked about. It doesn't necessarily need to keep to a Mediterranean flavored way of eating. I really hope you enjoyed today's pod. Do check out the podcast show notes, as well as the article that was written by Dr. Harrier on thedoctorskitchen.com, and I will see you here next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.